Hi, you're listening to the My Coach Cricket Show, and you can find us at pitchvision.com. I'm David Hinchliffe in the UK.
And I'm Kevin Sampath from Australia. Welcome to another week of the My Coach podcast. Hope you've all had a great week so far. How's your week been so far, David?
Great, thanks, Kevin. Yep, we've training hard and put a little bit of extra weight on my squat again this week. So I'm breaking a few personal bests, so I'm enjoying myself at the moment. So it's all going well.
That's good to hear. Looking forward to a bigger, better season coming up. When does your season start?
We have pre-season in April. So we have some friendlies in April, and then we move into the league in May. So there's a little way to go yet. But this is a good time for me. I enjoy this time of year because I can really concentrate on things that in the season you just haven't got the time or the energy to do, really. You know, you can't do heavy squatting during the cricket season because you just be knackered all the time.
Yeah, that's right.
So this time of year I really sort of three times a week I squat. And really go for a big sort of, you know, heavy load, 5 reps, and see how heavy I can go in the sort of period up to Christmas. So that's me. But you've been playing?
Yes, we've been playing, and our season's going okay so far. We've lost 2 out of 3, but our heads are up, and I think we have a good chance of at least contesting the league because we've seen good signs in our team throughout the 3 games so far, but there's just been a lack of team effort or just lack of responsibility in the team that's put us down. So we've had a meeting and we've thrown out our tips to improve, and hopefully this game coming up we can see signs of improvement.
Excellent. And how are you doing personally?
Personally, my batting's not going too well. I've started a bit slow. My highest score has been about 10 so far. Oh. But I am mainly a bowler, so I did want to improve a bit on the batting, but I read another article on Pitch Vision today about determination, and hopefully that's going to get me over the line in the next couple of games because my skill certainly isn't.
What's going wrong?
It's different things in different games. In my first game, it was technique, and then I worked a bit on that, and the second game, it was nerves. It's just I can't get everything right together at one time. There's always something going wrong, so I just have to work on all three, I guess.
What's your highest score? What have you managed in the past?
My highest score has been about 35 at school cricket, which where the bowlers aren't that great. Yeah, it's sort of like a good area to aim myself to get that kind of score again. Hopefully make a 50 one day.
When you find yourself getting into the 30s, you know, you can think, well, if I can get to 30, I can get to 50. It's sort of doing it one step at a time, isn't it? That's the mental trick. Yeah. Okay, well, good luck with that. Hopefully that goes well for you. How's the bowling?
Bowling, I haven't really bowled many overs either because our captain's been a bit protective of his younger bowlers and bowling most of his experienced bowlers. The games I have bowled, I've got a few wickets and signs are looking good so far. And especially at the start of the Australian season, there's a lot of wind. And there's still signs of winter and autumn about, so the ball swings around a bit. So that's been helpful for me personally. It should get harder though as summer kicks in.
Oh, as the pitches get harder and the weather is less conducive to swing.
Yeah, and it gets more friendly for the batsmen. So fingers crossed that I can pull up in those kinds of situations as well.
Well, we don't usually have that problem over here. Most of the time, it's you get weather and pitches which are suitable to swing bowlers most of the season.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's why we see, especially in international cricket, the different kinds of the bowlers from different countries how they adapt. Like Australia, you see a lot of sheer pace or getting cut off the seam or something, whereas England, you see a lot of swing bowlers around nowadays who are really effective as well, and same in India. So I guess there's a little bit to learn from everywhere.
There definitely is. You get so many sort of very medium-paced bowlers who can swing the ball a little bit, and they bowl it just back of a length with the seam up, and they get it. you're pretty much guaranteed to get two or three wickets every game because just conditions are on their side.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's not a bad thing. It makes a bit makes more of a challenge for the batsman, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, I think we should be getting on with our first section of today, which I think is some ideas you've been having and throwing around, David, about field placements and field settings. So could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. I've just started a new series on the My Coach section of the site on field settings for various different situations and various different bowlers.
Mm-hmm.
The chief executive of the company that make Pitch Vision, called Richard, he came up with something recently where he said that there's nowhere online where you can go to find a field for a particular situation. You know, there's no sort of database online for that. There's only so many field settings you could have, really. Well, basic field settings you could have, and then, you know, although there's theoretically an infinite number of variations on those field settings. But your basic field for, say, an off-spinner, your basic field for an away swing bowler is not going to be that different most of the time.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think it'll help the, batsmen as well. I mean, they can see, from reading all the articles and field settings you put up, they can sort of get an insight into what the captains are thinking or into what the bowlers are thinking as well. So it's going to help all players in the game, really.
Yeah, I think everyone should have an understanding of cricket strategy in general and field placings specifically, because you never know when you're going to find yourself in a position where you're going to need to place the field. It does happen, especially in club cricket, that it's happened to me. It happens where on the morning of the match, someone turns around and says, "Well, the captain's not playing today. You're in charge." So in a situation like that, it's important for you to know exactly what you're doing. And you're not just setting the field based on guesswork or what you've seen other people do. You know the theory behind it, and you have in your head an idea of a couple of different types of fields for different types of situations. So it definitely helps. And as you say, for batting as well. If the captain suddenly puts out a deep square leg and a deep fine leg, then you're probably thinking to yourself, maybe this bowler's going to be dropping a short one in a minute. So simple things like that. If you can understand field settings, you can know a little bit what's going on. But it all starts with the theory behind it, which is something I wanted to talk a little bit about.
Yeah.
Most people know the names of the positions. I mean, if you don't know the names of the positions, there's plenty of places to go online to find that information out. You know, if you don't know where silly mid-on stands, it's pretty easy to find out that information. But the only place I've ever seen online which explains why you would put a silly mid-on in or any other position is on the Pitch Vision site. I did an article back in 2006 called Setting the Field Theory and Practice.
Yeah.
And I'll put a link up to that in the show notes. But in that I explain the sort of three main principles of setting the field.
Mm-hmm.
The first of those principles is the core positions, the core six positions of the field. Obviously, you've got the bowler and the batsman, the bowler and the wicketkeeper, I should say.
Yeah.
But after that, you've got nine other fielders that you want to put somewhere. Now, the core of that, the skeleton, if you like, from which you hang the flesh and bones of the rest of the field placings, are mid-on, mid-off, mid-wicket, cover, third man, and fine leg. Now, the reason they are important is if you imagine those, and there's a diagram on the site, but if you imagine those, they form a straight line on the offside and a straight line on the onside, which is the opposite of the V that most good batsmen are trying to hit the ball through. So if you've got a bowler who's trying to pitch the ball up on the off stump, which most bowlers do on a good length on the off stump, it doesn't matter what type of bowler they are, that's generally a good line to bowl. Then you're going to want those six, some variation of those six positions in place.
Yeah.
So the mid on and the mid off, they're there to stop the straight drives. the third man and the fine leg are there to stop the edges from attempted straight drives, and the extra cover in the mid wicket stop the wider drives.
Yeah.
So in theory, if you've got those six fielders, and you've got a bowler who can put the ball on a length, just on or just outside the off stump every single ball, then that's all the fielders you'll ever need, in theory, because the batsman's only ever going to be trying. The only way he can get out of that is to drive, in theory.
Yeah.
So that leaves you with three spare fielders that you can set anywhere you like, whether you want to have them attacking or defensive, that's up to you. But those are your sort of your three sort of spare fielders, if you like, for that particular strategy. You could have, say, for example, you know, two slips and a gully if you're opening the bowling and you're an away swing bowler. You know, that would be your three.
Yeah.
But if you wanted to attack a little bit more, say you were an away swing bowler, you wanted to attack a little bit more, then you can take one of those core positions and you can move them into a more attacking position. So say you're an opening away swing bowler, you've got two slips and a gully in place, and you want to attack a little bit more, then you can take out the third man and move him into third slip. So the third man is still there, he's just very close now. Instead of being in the normal sort of third man position, he's right up in a catching position. You've got three slips and a gully then. There's your variation on the theme. So that's the second principle, which is variation.
Yeah.
So
okay.
The main factors on the variations are the match situation, you know, whether you're attacking and defending, the type of bowling that you've got, spinners, seamers, whatever they are, the conditions of the pitch, whether it's slow or fast, whether it's turning, whether it's seaming.
Yeah.
The accuracy of the bowling, the amount of movement that you're getting in the air or off the pitch, and the limitations of the batsman.
Going back to those core positions, which you mentioned, the six core positions, could it change differing in different situations? So say an example is in our cricket team, we only have two people on the leg side who's a floating mid-wicket and about a square leg.
Sure.
Is it really important to have the six core positions, or can that be messed around with a little bit as well?
What we're talking about there is a 6-2 field where you've got six. A 7-2 field where you've got seven fielders on the offside and two fielders on the leg side.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so where's the bowler bowling in that situation? What line is he bowling? It's sort of fifth stump, is it?
Yeah, well, he's trying to keep it outside off as much as possible to get to make the batsman either drive outside off or just play one of those risky cut shots or something, just to get him to play on the offside.
Okay. And does he swing the ball? Or move the ball off the seam?
Yeah, well, if he didn't, we would have more people on the leg side, I reckon, but...
Okay, so yeah, in that situation, if you've got someone bowling outside the off stump and the ball is swinging away or not swinging at all, then you could be advised to be moving, say, your mid on over to the offside. So, yeah, it's very important to take the tactics and the game situation into account. So in that situation, you could easily move the mid on across or the mid wicket across.
Okay.
And then bring up the fine leg up to square leg. Now, the only problem with doing that is you have to have a bowler who is consistently bowling fairly wide outside the off stump, which is a reasonable tactic. There's nothing wrong with that tactic. But if you have someone who strays too straight, then the batsman can flick the ball off his legs and he's got a boundary or certainly a two or a three, because square leg has to chase around behind square.
Yeah.
So you've got the risk there. So it's a risk analysis that the captain has to be doing all the time.
Yeah.
I'm stacking the covers with lots of fielders. I'm trying to stop a player from scoring, basically, by doing that, with that option.
Okay.
Really, you're not going to take wickets by doing that particularly, are you? Because the batsman could leave it all day long if he wanted to.
Yeah. So you would see that as more of a defensive approach?
It depends on the batsman, of course, because if the batsman is an aggressive batsman and you're giving him balls wide outside the off stump all the time, and he's decides to have a go at one of them,
yeah,
then he might nick off.
Yeah, that's right.
But on the other hand, if he's a batsman who's quite happy to stay in, you know, to grind it out and just wait for the bad ball, then he's just leaving it all the time. And you've stacked the covers, so even if he does get a half volley, he hits it into the covers, you've got a cover, you've got an extra cover, you've got square cover, it's unlikely that he's going to score a boundary.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
So it's quite a defensive tactic, but it depends on the batsman, of course, and that's where the variations come in.
Okay.
You're always thinking about your core field, but you don't have to stick with those six fielders if you've got a specific tactic in mind like that one is.
Yeah, okay.
So that's quite a good example of using variation there.
Yeah.
Another example of using variation is looking at the batsmen themselves and saying, how is he playing, and how can we set the field to where he's hitting the ball? So you've got a player who's predominantly doing back foot drives, you know, his main shot is the back foot straight drive. Is there any point in having a gully in place? Is there any point in having a square leg in place, for example?
Yeah.
Or would you be better with a very straight mid-off and an extra cover and a gap square on the offside because the ball's never going there?
Yeah.
It's something that the captain has to be thinking about all the time. How is this player playing? And how can I set the field to make sure that the fielders are standing where the ball is going? The third principle that I want to mention is bluff. And this kind of goes against the first two principles, because the first two principles, the whole idea is we want to put fielders where we think the ball is going to go.
Yeah.
And you start that with your basic six positions, then you build in your variations, and hopefully then you've got a field where the ball is going. But the third principle, bluff, is you want to put someone where the ball isn't very likely to go for some reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a good example of that is if you've got an off-spinner who perhaps no one has seen particularly bowl before, and you bring him on and you station two short legs straight away because you want to trick the batsman into thinking that the ball is turning.
Yeah.
But you know that the off-spinner doesn't turn the ball very much and it's not really a turning pitch anyway.
Yeah.
You might just get the batsman playing down the wrong line and edging it to slip. So you have two short legs and a slip in, but you know those two short legs are never going to see the ball. So there's an example of bluff in place. Or you could put an extra slip in for your away swing bowler just to try and fool the opening batsman that the ball is swinging.
Yeah.
Now, it may not work. And even if it does work, it's not going to work for very long, but it might be enough to get you a wicket. So you have to be careful when you bluff. But it's a good tactic to try every now and again, just to try and fool somebody. The other reason you would have a bluff position, if you like, is if you've got a particularly poor fielder.
Okay.
Normally the really, really bad fielders are hidden in some way or another. So, for example, you might have if we're talking about our off-spin example, if you've got a really bad fielder, a good place to have them is sort of square cover or gully.
Yeah.
Because if the ball's turning into a right-handed batsman, it's not very likely to be going to gully or square cover very often.
Yeah, that's right.
So you've got him tucked in there. Or you could put a bad fielder into a bluff position like your short leg to your off-spinner who doesn't really turn the ball,
mm-hmm,
just to hide him somewhere. So it's a good idea to know not only where the ball is likely to go, but also to know where the ball is not likely to go. So if you do need to hide a fielder, then you can hide them in that particular position. And that does vary depending on the type of batsman who's batting, and also what's happening with the ball, whether you've got a spinner or a swing bowler, and which way it's swinging or which way it's spinning and all the rest of it. But those are your three. As long as you've got those three basic principles in mind, the core positions, the variations on those core positions, and the bluff, then that's enough to see you through most match situations. Especially if you've got a bowler who's experienced and they know what kind of field that they like to have.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to do is, over the coming weeks, I'm going to be posting up fields for different types of bowlers, standard fields for different types of bowlers from various places. I've got some fields sort of on file, and I'll be posting those up on pitchvision.com so people can have a look and think to themselves, yep, that's a good field. And if they don't think it's a good field, then feel free to change it to your own requirements. There's no problem with that. What I want to do is just sort of give examples of what can be done in certain situations. But that's the great thing about field settings. There's an infinite number of variables.
Yeah.
That's what makes it fun.
Okay. Well, I'm sure there'll be lots of help for a lot of people. And I think it makes true to the statement that cricket really is a thinking game, and there's a lot of mental thinking involved in cricket, and fielding is just another example of outsmarting the opponent, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been a captain, but if you're really thinking about what's going on, you're trying to think maybe four or five overs ahead all the time. You come off the field feeling absolutely knackered.
Yeah.
Because you've been thinking all the time. And it's hard work, you know, because you can think about two different batsmen, the bat situation, how it's changing. Suddenly you could be going from defence to attack if you get a couple of wickets. There's so much going on that it's a real mental challenge. That's what makes cricket such a great game, the mental challenge, I think, anyway.
If there are any questions regarding the field placements or anything, feel free to leave a comment on any of those articles or email us at micoach@pitchvision.com. We'll move on to the questions now.
Yeah, just before we do, Kevin, just want to say on the forum, if you go to pitchvision.com forum, then you can see on the forum page there's a post where I'm asking for people to put whatever fields they usually have up, just so we've got sort of record of from around the world of everyone who's a bowler, what fields they have. So if you have your own special field that you love to have, then head over to pitchvision.com/forum and put your own field down, because I'm trying to get a record of every field that we could reasonably have.
Okay, sounds good. Moving on to our first question for today from Cody. He says, he or she says, "Hi, I'm only 13 and play club and district level cricket, and nearly every coach says I need to pick up my speed between the wickets and in the field, etc. Could you please help me? Thanks." Thoughts, David?
Yeah, speed is one of those difficult things, because if you think, well, I need to get faster, how do I train for speed? That's a very difficult thing, because speed isn't really something in itself. It's an amalgamation of other things. It's sort of technique, power, strength, mobility,
yeah,
stability. It's lots of things put together. So it's a pretty hard one to answer. I mean, if we're talking about running between the wickets and chasing the ball in the field, then
yeah,
you probably want to think more about acceleration than you do speed, because top speed is something that you rarely get to when you're playing cricket, because if you're running between the wickets, you only sprint 20 yards before you're having to stop, turn around and go back the other way.
Yeah.
So unlike, say, a 100-meter runner, it's not as important to get up to top speed. It's more important to get from nothing to as fast as possible in the shortest amount of time, and that is acceleration.
Yeah.
So, which I've done an article on acceleration, so you can have a look at that. Basically, what that says is, you need to increase all the different factors that go into speed and acceleration, and that will then get your speed up. The first thing you always look at when you're talking about speed is technique, especially for running between the wickets, because there is a definite technique to running between the wickets.
Yeah.
That can make a big difference. You often see people running between the wickets much slower than they should do, because they haven't really worked on their running between the wicket technique. The main thing that I see is people not running in a straight line.
Yeah.
because they, you know, have to run around another batsman or a bowler or fielder or something like that. If you have to do it, then fair enough. But wherever possible, you should run in a straight line, because the shortest distance between two points is running in a straight line.
Yeah.
The other thing is turning. You see a lot of players not stopping, getting low down, sliding the bat in and pushing off quickly, which is something that you see that you can take for an example of sprinting. They come out the blocks, they start low and they come out the blocks quickly. If you sort of amble up to the wicket, tap your bat down and amble off again, then you're adding enough time to maybe get run out. So you have to really be going fast, stopping fast and turning fast. That all has to be done quickly.
Yeah.
And I've got a post on the right technique for doing that as well. So I'll put a link to that article up. The other key thing you can do when it comes to acceleration is to work on your leg power, really.
Okay.
So the way to do that, which I'm always talking about, is, you know, you have to do some kind of strength training work.
Yeah.
I know people don't necessarily like listening to that. A lot of people are against strength training.
Yeah.
But it will definitely improve your speed and your acceleration if you do the right kind of strength training. That's just a fact. And
yeah.
Okay, you know, your judgment of a run is important, your technique is important, but you give me one person who's stronger than the other and everything else is equal, then the stronger one will be faster.
Yeah, that's right.
The bottom line. And also, if you're carrying a little bit of extra weight, then it's important to get the body fat down as much as you can, mm-hmm. without obsessing about it, obviously. But if you get the body fat down, you've got less to carry, you're going to go faster.
Yeah.
You would if, you know, you've got someone who weighs 12 stone, someone who weighs 15 stone, the 12 and everything else is equal, the 12 stone person will be faster.
He's also mentioned about speed and fielding in his question. Would you say sort of predicting or prediction while fielding would help his speed while fielding, do you reckon? Like, say he's fielding at cover or something and he gets a half volley in by seeing the movement of that, or judging the batsman's movement, he could judge which side to move. Like Andrew Simons and Michael Clarke seem to be very good movers in the field by prediction. What would be your views on that?
Absolutely. Anticipation.
Yeah.
It's what we're talking about there, really.
Yeah.
And your ability to anticipate the ball is crucial. That will allow you to get into position a lot more quickly. And if you're in the right position a lot more quickly, then you won't have to be as fast, because you'll be more likely to be stopping the ball in the first place.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, anticipation is crucial. You know, just like a good goalkeeper can anticipate where the ball's going to be going almost before it's been kicked. And a good tennis player can judge a serve before it's been hit.
Yeah.
Then, by the way a batsman is shaping up, the better you can anticipate that, the quicker you'll be. Now, the problem is with that is it's quite hard to train anticipation. It's one of those things that you've got to kind of learn.
Yeah.
And you find some people are better than others. You mentioned Andrew Simons.
Yeah.
I know that the left-arm spinner who's just come into the England side,
mm-hmm.
whose name is Samit Patel,
yeah.
is extremely good at anticipation. If you ever see him fielding, when he fields in the infield,
yeah.
he hardly ever seems to be diving for the ball or doing anything spectacular,
yeah.
because he just always seems to be in the right place.
Yeah.
And that's because he has this sort of sixth sense almost of where the ball's going to be going. So he just goes and stands where the ball's going to be going instead of having to throw himself around.
Yeah.
Which is handy for him because he's a bigger lad.
Yeah.
So throwing himself around is probably a bit more difficult than someone like Ponting, who's all sort of lean muscle.
Yeah.
So yeah, I probably have to look into that a little bit more, but anticipation is a crucial factor. Yeah, I agree with you on that one, Kevin.
Yeah, and going back to batting, David, I saw recently a masterclass something by Ponting, and he mentioned about, just like you did, the importance of technique, and he also said that Speed is important, but if you get your technique right, it's as crucial as anything else. Could you have speed without technique, or would you need technique as well?
If you just had raw speed,
Yeah.
you're probably better off as a sprinter.
Okay.
Because without technique, it is almost completely useless.
Yeah.
And when I say speed, I mean sort of acceleration. You know, the first few steps where you go from zero to, or walking pace to top speed very quickly. That in its, I mean, obviously the quicker you can get from point A to point B, the better.
Yeah.
But it's just one factor. You know, for running between the wickets particularly, if you're running a quick single, then yeah, it's going to be all about acceleration, really.
Yeah.
Although there is a little bit of technique at the end where you're sliding the bat in.
Yeah.
Keeping low, you're sliding the bat in. It's all about acceleration there. But if you're running a 2 or a 3, then it's a critical point is how fast you can stop yourself from going at top speed and how quickly you can turn and get going in the other direction.
Yeah.
And a big element of that is technique. The
yeah.
better your technique is at that, the better. But it's all linked in, obviously, because, you know, the stronger you are, the more mobile you are, the stronger your core is,
yeah.
to use a modern term, core. The stronger your core is, the better your technique is likely to be anyway. So it's all linked in. But yeah, technique is a crucial factor, no doubt about it. It's no good just being fast. You've got to be. You've got to have the technique down.
Okay.
And the good thing about that is you can practice that. You can practice technique. You can set up a practice session, and there is an article on the My Coach pages on how to set up a practice session to improve your running between the wickets. And at club level, any club who does that, one or two practice sessions where they improve their running between the wickets, they could get anything up to 40 or 50 more runs per innings just by adding an extra run per over.
Yeah.
Because they run, you know, they're stealing the old quicks, they're stealing quick singles, making twos into threes, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And at club level, that's a huge, huge, huge difference. And it's a big limitation. That's kind of off the topic.
Yeah.
I think that probably covers it in the time that we have. You know, I don't want to go into great detail, but there are lots and lots of articles on My Coach. So I'll put up some links to a couple of those. And if you want to know more details, you can have a look at those. But the basic principles, stick with those.
We'll go to our second question from Trevor. And he asks, I coach an under-16 development side in Brisbane, Australia. We played on a damp pitch this weekend and 9 wickets fell from catches forward of the wicket. This indicated to me that the pitch was a little slow and that players were playing their shots too early. My question is, what type of batting drills would you suggest so that I can teach the batsman to wait for the ball a little longer and hopefully avoid this happening in the future? Before I hand it over to you, David, I think this is important for all Australian batsmen and players because we are sort of used to the bouncy and pacey wickets that when we do experience sort of pitches that keep low or aren't as fast as the other wickets, we do really struggle. So I'm really interested in hearing what you have to say about this as well.
It's quite common over here in the UK in club cricket to have pitches which are not that fantastic quality, and you do get slow and low pitches.
Yeah.
Really, the best way to get used to playing on slow and low pitches is to play on slow and low pitches. That's a bit of a glib answer in a way, because you know that's not really the question. But in one way, as long as those kids are thinking about it, you know, as long as the coach sits down with those kids after the match and say why do you think you were getting out? Why do you think you got out like that? And they're thinking about it, then that's going to give them experience for the next time they're in that situation. So the more they're in that situation, the better.
Yep.
So it's almost saying, well, don't really particularly worry about drilling to do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I would say that it's probably, rather than looking at that particular situation, which you may or may not come across very often, it depends where you are in the world.
Yeah.
As long as your technique is reasonably good, then you don't need to necessarily worry about mistiming the ball. You just, when you get out in the middle, you just need to think about it for a little while, get the pace of the pitch, and then get going. You can't really practice that, but what you can practice is good technique. So,
yeah,
getting players to play practice games, you know, ideally on lower pitches, or perhaps use balls which are, you know, which naturally keep a little bit lower, perhaps with less bounce. You know, older balls which have less bounce on them to help with that situation. Yeah, that'd be a good way to do it. Practice games are a brilliant way to do it. In terms of drilling, I wouldn't do a massive amount of drilling unless you've got someone with a clear technical flaw, and then probably you want to step in and do some work with them with tennis balls and bobble feeds and that kind of thing to try and groove someone's technique a little bit better. Make sure their hands are working together properly, you know, their head is in the right position, those key things. Then after that, it's just a matter of getting used to the bounce and the speed of the pitch, of different pitches. And there really isn't any way of practicing that apart from actually playing. So if you can play practice matches, that's all well and good.
Yeah.
If you can't play practice matches, then it makes it a bit more difficult, because just netting isn't that great an idea. So it's a tricky one, but I would perhaps say that drilling isn't the answer. You might want to perhaps look at more practice matches.
Adding to that, I've seen a lot of people practice with sort of fluffy carpets on the pitches, because I've heard that when balls hit like sort of fluffy carpets, they tend to keep low and they come slower off the pitch as well. So that sort of trains into them to play off the slow balls or balls that keep low or something like that. I haven't really actually seen it, but I've heard of my mates or people from other teams practicing in that way. I don't know if it's useful or not, but I guess there's no harm in trying.
It all helps. Obviously, anything that can recreate the situation as closely as possible is going to help. So that's a good idea. That sounds like a good idea. As long as it accurately, the ball behaviour is the same as the ball behaviour that you get out in the middle.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's pointless. But as long as the ball is behaving in roughly the right way, then you're away to go. It's a matter, when you're hitting the ball in the air, then you might be looking at technical errors, but you're probably looking at timing errors. And if it's a timing error, you just need to get used to the timing of that particular speed and bounce of the ball. So yeah, it's a good idea. I've not heard of that. So yeah, that's another variation which could be a good idea.
All right, let's get on to our third question for the day from Tom. And Tom asks, I play competitive cricket in the Bristol area, and I've been injured all season with a back problem. I've got the all clear from the physio, and I need to get cricket fit for the start of the university and club season. Any ideas? I net once a week for the university, up until the start of the uni season.
Well, that's a huge question, really, isn't it? You know, how do I get fit for cricket? You know, it's a massive, massive question.
Yeah.
I don't really know Tom's particular circumstances. He hasn't given me any more details than what you've just read out there.
Yeah.
So it'd be hard for me to say specifically. But let's assume that he hasn't done much fitness work in the past. And even if he has, then if he's had a bad back, then he probably hasn't been doing much recently.
Yeah.
So he's probably starting out from a position where he's fairly unconditioned in some way or another. So,
yeah.
You know, maybe he's carrying a little bit of extra weight. He might be. And even if he's not, maybe perhaps his strength and his power and his work capacity is lower than he would want it to be.
Yeah.
He also didn't say what the back problem was, so we'll assume he's healthy, completely healthy on that.
Yeah.
What I would say is, if you're just starting out in a situation like that, you're probably best, especially this time of year in the UK, you're probably best doing something very simple but covers a lot of bases.
Mm.
So the thing I most people would benefit from that from there would be circuit training, in my opinion.
Okay.
Now, if you don't know what circuit training is, it's pretty simple. It's you get a bunch of exercises, and you do each you do each exercise for either a certain number of repetitions or a set amount of time before moving on to the next exercise.
Okay.
And you do one, that's called one circuit, when you do all those exercises in one go. And then mm-hmm. when you finish that circuit, you have a rest, and then you do it again, and you do it again, and however many times you do it. Now, the good thing about circuit training is it hits a lot of things in one go. It yeah. hits strength, it hits power, it hits work capacity, and it hits overall mobility and flexibility all in one go.
Okay.
The downside of it is it's not as effective as working on those things individually, and it's not as good at progressing. So once you get to a certain point, you can't go any further with it. So you have to move on to something else. But if you're just starting out, you're just coming back from injury, then it's a great way to start, because you can. There's an ultimate, infinite number of variations that you can do with circuit training. So you could start with, if you didn't want to go to the gym, or you didn't want to go to circuit training class. Most fitness places will do some kind of circuit training class.
Yeah.
But if you didn't want to do that, then you can just do it at home if you like. You can do bodyweight exercises and start, you know, with press ups and inverted rows. I'm not a big fan of sit ups, but you know sit ups you could do. Although maybe he wouldn't want to if he's had a bad back, but
yeah,
and that's another question.
Yeah.
Bodyweight squats, bodyweight lunges, those kind of things. So you can do that kind of thing, or you can head into the gym. You can do circuit training with dumbbells, you can do circuit training with barbells.
Okay.
So it's an extremely flexible method of training. So that's where I would start. I would certainly start with someone who's deconditioned with 2 to 3 times a week of doing that. And probably you want to do that for something like 6 to 12 weeks, something in that period of time. If you can do that, then you're going to be a hell of a lot fitter and stronger than you were when you started 6 to 12 weeks ago. Then you can either continue with that, find a way of progressing it in some way, or you can move on to splitting up your training into different sort of components, if you like, and working more on specific things, doing interval training, doing weightlifting, that kind of thing, if you so desire. But if you haven't got the time or the inclination to do that, it's fine just to carry on with circuit training. But you probably want to mix it up a little bit in some way or another. And, you know, if you've been working with body weight, move on to dumbbells or something like that.
Okay. Would you recommend any exercises for his back? Maybe you could start small. I mean, start with lower weights and try to strengthen his back so the injury doesn't come back. Or would you say it's too dangerous?
It depends on a couple of factors. The first thing is, we don't really know what the back injury was. It could have been something like lower back pain. Could have been a stress fracture. It could have been something in his upper back. We don't really know what happened. It could have been something serious or something relatively not serious. So we've got to be careful about recommendations there. But what you can do is you can say, right, generally speaking, anyone who's healthy and wants to maintain a healthy back, you probably want to be having some kind of stabilizing exercises for your core muscles.
Yeah.
Because the job of the muscles in your midsection, the main job of your muscles in your midsection, is to hold your back in the right position while you're doing all kinds of crazy things like bowling or batting or fielding. So if you think of something simple, very, very simple, like a plank exercise, if you don't know what that is, the plank is where you you're lying down on your front, and you put your weight on your elbows and your forearms, and then you lift up your hips, so you're in a straight line from your head down to your toes, which are on the floor as well. So that's why it's called a plank, because you're in the shape of a plank, where your arms are supporting your upper body. Now, if you can hold that position for 30 seconds, even if you do it with 10 seconds on, rest, 5 seconds, another 10 seconds, rest, another 10 seconds. If you can do that 3 times a week, then that's going to strengthen the stabilizing muscles in your midsection. So it's a very simple exercise, a plank. You can do that. You can add that into circuit training, no problem at all. So that's a good general recommendation to make. I don't want to say anything specific about Tom, but generally speaking, if you're doing planks as an exercise, that's stabilizing all your muscles and keeping your back in a good position, even when you're doing very explosive things like playing a cricket shot or bowling a cricket ball.
Well, last week we got a reader sending a question about weight training for an under 16-year-old. Sort of left it unmentioned. Would you like to sort of start off with that, David?
Yeah, I did forget to mention that last week, and I think it's quite an important topic. Weight training for under 16s or under 18s is quite a hot topic, especially in terms of safety. A lot of people say it's unsafe to do weight training if you're under a certain age. And it's a complicated question. It's not as simple as if you're under 16 or if you're under 18, never lift up a weight in your life. Otherwise, you'll stunt your growth and have a bad back for the rest of your life. It isn't as simple as that at all. General recommendation, I probably wouldn't recommend weight training for anybody under 18. And the reason is not to do with the weight training itself. It's to do with the fact that it's very hard to find someone to teach you the correct technique for weightlifting if you're under 18 years old.
Yeah.
It's very hard for anyone to get correct teaching for weight training. In fact, you know, most modern gyms, if you walk into a modern gym, you probably wouldn't find anyone who could teach you the correct technique for cleans or even for barbell rows, which is an exercise which, if you get it wrong, can cause you problems. Let alone squats or deadlifts, which are more complicated exercises. So you have to be very careful. And if you're under 18, then what you don't want to be doing is getting into bad habits early on, because they're very hard to correct later on if you're in a bad habit from a young age. Now, that said, in theory, there's no reason why anyone couldn't learn good weightlifting technique from a very young age. Under the age of about 11, you're probably looking at, although it can be done, you're probably looking at attention span, and there's better things you can do for kids that age that can help with strength training. Theoretically, just about any age can do it. Certainly over the age of 11, you can certainly learn correct technique for weightlifting. Now, that doesn't mean you should learn the correct technique 1 week and then suddenly pile on massive weights the next week and start lifting as biggest weight as you can manage immediately the next week. You have to build it up slowly. You have to start with relatively low weights, maintain good technique at all times, and don't go too heavy too early on. Mm-hmm. But there's no reason why you can't, even at the age of 12, 13, 14, 15, learn how to correctly perform a clean or a snatch with a broomstick, then maybe move on to a small bar, then a bigger bar, and then start putting weights on. But all that, you can do that over a period of months. You don't have to do that over a period of a week.
Yeah.
So everyone who plays cricket, I would say that you should go to the gym and you should learn how to lift weights correctly, and then you should lift weights.
Yeah.
Age isn't really much of a factor. But the problem is that what should happen and what does happen are two very different things. So you do get the problem of not being able to learn proper technique if you're under 18. So as a general recommendation, don't start lifting weights until you're over 18, unless you can find someone who specialises in teaching correct technique to people who are under 18, just for safety's sake.
I've heard things that if you're under 16, until the age of 16, it's best to use your body weight for strength training and other sorts of training. Do you think that's a myth, or is that safe to advise to under 16-year-olds?
As a safety recommendation, that's perfectly fine, yeah. I mean, in terms of physiology, there's no reason why anyone under 16 or 16 or 17 or 18 can't lift resistance either. I mean, you get kids, very young kids, doing gymnastics, and the forces involved in gymnastics are many times the body weight. You know, when you're jumping around, that's many times someone's body weight, mm-hmm. because of gravitational force. It increases the amount of force that happens. Yet, you know, you can't give a child a broomstick and teach them how to do a squat, because that's unsafe.
Yeah.
But that's not true. It's you can give a child a broomstick and teach them how to squat correctly, teach them how to deadlift correctly, mm-hmm. without any problems. You can even start adding resistance, external resistance, without any problems. With that said, as a general rule, body weight training for under 16 is a good way to go. If you can't be taught technique by someone who really knows what they're doing.
Is there an age you would recommend that it's safe to start weight training from?
Physiologically speaking, you can start weight training from probably 5 or 6 years old.
Okay.
In terms of physiology. There's no physiological reason why you can't start weight training from extremely young. But you try and teach a 5-year-old how to do a deadlift or a squat, they just get bored and fed up and walk off and do something else. So you have to take in the maturity factor, the psychological maturity of the child. If you get a kid, you get kids who are 12 who seem like they're 25.
Yeah.
And you get kids who are 12 who seem like they're 7. So you've got to take it on a case-by-case basis, and if you've got a kid who is immature for their age, and that's no problem, because everyone develops at a different speed. If you've got a kid who's immature for their age, then don't worry about the weightlifting technique necessarily. Do something else. Just get them running around. Too many kids, they don't even run around anymore. So just get them running around and doing stuff that they enjoy, and worry about learning weightlifting later on. But yeah, there's no physiological reason why you can't learn weightlifting from a very young age. One of the myths is that it stunts your growth.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot.
It doesn't.
It doesn't?
It doesn't. There's no evidence to show that.
No. Okay.
There's no evidence to show that. If, I can see the theory, if you stack a lot of weight on your back and do back squats when you're still growing, then a lot of weight can compress the spine, and particularly if you're doing it a lot of weight with a poor technique, then I can possibly see there might be some issue there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're lifting with good technique and you're not lifting too heavy weights, then there's no evidence that it stunts your growth. But the key is technique. Technique is everything when it comes to weightlifting, really.
Yeah,
the weight is not as important. The amount of resistance is not as important as doing it right.
Yeah,
because if you have several years as a junior learning how to do it correctly, and then when you get to a point where you're not growing anymore, mm-hmm. then you can start putting lifting much heavier weights if you so desire.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, technique especially can be the difference between strength gain and a really bad injury, I guess.
Yeah. If you look at rates of injuries for weightlifting, they're way down. Playing cricket is a lot more dangerous, statistically speaking, than weightlifting is.
Yeah.
If you look at injury rates. But most injuries when it comes to weightlifting are caused by poor form through trying to lift too much weight too quickly.
Yeah.
Especially with the boys, teenage boys, who maybe have other goals in mind rather than just improving their performance on the cricket pitch. Maybe they want nice big pecs and big biceps to impress the ladies. Which is fine, there's no problem with that. If that's what you want to do, get on with it. We all want to impress the ladies, don't we?
Yeah.
But that can cause people to think, well, if I lift more weight, I'll have bigger muscles. So, I want bigger muscles, so I'll lift more weight, and they're lifting more weight than they're capable of lifting.
Yeah.
And that's where it all goes wrong, and that's where you get injuries.
Yeah.
But that's nothing to do with age.
Yeah.
That's everything to do with ego.
Yeah. And as you mentioned before, maturity as well.
Maturity is a big thing.
Yeah.
Because we all have our biological age is different from our what mental state that we're in.
Yeah.
Everyone matures at a different rate.
Any last comments you'd like to add to that?
Not really, only to say that if you agree or disagree or want any clarification on any points, then you have our email address by now, hopefully, which is mycoach@pitchvision.com. And also we have a forum, which is at pitchvision.com/forum, where you can go and post your comments about anything that you like. And I pretty much reply to most comments on there. So especially if anyone's asking a question on there, I'll always reply to any questions that are posted on there.
As David mentioned, if there are any questions, please email us at mycoach@pitchvision.com. That's mycoach@pitchvision.com. Thanks for listening again. So from Australia, this is Kevin Sampat signing off.
And this is David Hinchliffe in the UK.